Yeah. So, whoa.
Okay, I'm going to call to order this March 4th, 2015 meeting of the Senate Committee on Workforce. Colleagues, welcome. My Democratic colleagues should be down any moment. Audience, welcome. We have several public hearings today on very diverse subjects, all of them very interesting. And we also have we have two work sessions scheduled. Colleagues, let me tell you that Senate Bill 128, the fiscal is not ready yet because we have some amendments there, so we're going to carry that forward until Monday. And then Senate Bill 586, we will have a work session on, and that one is going to have to go to Ways and Means, and I'll explain that. So let me start off by opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 491. And Senator Montesanders, if you could come forward, and Matt, if you could tell us what this bill is about.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 491 prohibits a state agency from pre-qualifying a prospective bidder that employs 40 or more workers unless the prospective bidder submits a certificate showing participation in a Department of Administrative Services pay equity training program. It directs the department to establish a pay equity training program and requires contractors to allow employees to discuss compensation and benefits with other employees without retaliation. The measure becomes operative on January 1st, 2016, and declares an emergency effective on passage.
Thank you, Chair.
Senator Sanderson, welcome. And let me just say, colleagues, Representative Comp would like to speak on this bill as well, but she's tied up. Something's going on over in the House chamber. And so she'll come if and when she can.
I think her arm also might be broken, not just tied up.
All right. Thank
she
you,
was
Mr.
tied
Chair
up. She's
and
now
members
free.
Of the committee. I am State Senator Lori Montes Anderson. I represent Gresham, Troutdale, Wood Village, Fairview, and parts of East Portland. I bring before you Senate Bill 491, and thank you so much for hearing it. Gender pay equity has been an extremely important topic for, I think, every woman. And this bill will help to level the playing field in the workforce between men and women, which is essential to expanding opportunity and growing Oregon's economy. This legislation will eliminate barriers for women by ensuring equal pay for equal work. Currently, I've been told, that in Oregon, on an average, women earn an average 80 cents for every dollar a man makes. What Senate Bill 491 will require is that businesses with 50 or more employees, and I know it says in their bill 40, but we have some amendments coming, and there will be someone to address the amendments after I'm finished. But with 50 or more employees, seeking state contracts of over $500,000 to certify there are no pay gaps between men and women by job class. In Senate Bill 491, it requires DAS to develop an online training and certification module to allow vendors to prove knowledge of state and federal pay equity laws. And it requires vendors bidding on contracts over $500,000 and who have 50 or more FTE to then submit the certification of having taken the training with their proposal as part of the responsible bidder requirement. This bill will also allow the vending community time to comply without losing opportunities to bid on contracts. I really urge you to pass this very important piece of legislation. It helps women, it increases fairness in the workforce, and it will ultimately improve our economy. Thank you so much. And there have been a number of people who would like even additional amendments, but I'll let them come up and let them know their views to you.
Thank you, Senator, and thank you for bringing this bill forward. I agree that this is an issue of great importance to all women. It's also of great interest to men as well.
Thank you.
Any questions of the Senator, colleagues?
Thank you very much.
Okay, how about Madeline Zeich? From DAS and Trish Garner.
Good
Carolyn, you want to start off and tell us how this would work in the DAS world?
Certainly. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Madeline Zeich. I'm the Chief Human Resources Officer at DAS, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak to the committee about Senate Bill 491. DAS introduced similar legislation this session, and we're working with the sponsor to integrate those concepts in the bill. So I believe I'm one of those people that she said would be coming before you with amendments. I'll be brief today in the interest of your time, but wanted to provide some history regarding these concepts and DAS's level of effort. The President released an executive order in 2014 that promoted greater awareness and understanding of labor requirements for federal contractors, as well as best practices for obtaining compliance with these requirements. The executive orders required federal contractors with contracts exceeding $500,000 to understand and comply with labor laws, including pay equity and non-retaliation for disclosure of compensation information. At that time, we were asked by the governor to propose similar language in our legislation in support of pay equity. With that, and in the spirit of working with our sponsor, with the sponsor of this particular bill, I'd like to suggest some proposed amendments to include our concepts into this bill. The first would be that it would require DAS to develop an online training and certification module to allow vendors to demonstrate knowledge of state and federal pay equity laws. We would also recommend that we amend ORS 279 to require vendors bidding on contracts over $500,000 and who have 50 or more FTE to submit certification of having taken the training with their proposal as part of the bidder requirements. We envision this to be an online training format with an associated certificate that DAS would issue after completion. This bill would also provide DAS and the vendor community with time to comply with the legislation. As far as any fiscal impacts to DAS, this will result in minimal impact to the Office of the CHRO. We can create the online training module. It's available using our existing software, and we feel that we can do that rather quickly. It's not a huge burden as we already have the technology and staff available. So that's it for my comments today. I do have someone here from DAS Procurement if you have any specific procurement questions, because that is not my expertise at the Office of the CHRO. Thank you again for allowing me to provide you with some information regarding this particular bill.
Thank you very much, Madeline. I have a quick question about the training, the online training that would happen. Who would need to take that training as you envision it?
So, Mr. Chair, as this bill is written, it would be those that are bidding on contracts for over $500,000 and have 50 or more FTE. As I see it, the company would provide us with a representative of their company that would take the training. They would be delivered with the certificate, and then they'd present it as part of their bidder package.
And presumably that would be someone who would then have some authority in the company to make sure that that's enforced, that it would be somebody in their HR, or how do you think that would work?
Mr. Chair, we'll be working with our procurement staff to further define who that might be within a particular company. They can probably provide us a little bit more guidance about the appropriate individuals within a proposer's structure to complete the training.
Okay, thank you. Questions, colleagues?
I guess maybe I just have one question as to, since you're maybe a little closer to it than some of us on the committee, what do you anticipate changing as far as pay equity laws? Will they pretty much stay? I mean, yeah. Are there a lot of proposals out there that you see will be changed, cause some changes? I know you can't predict what we're going to do, but is your department forwarding some changes that you believe have legs, I guess?
Mr. Chair, Senator Thatcher, this is one of the ways, from my perspective, that we influence pay equity within the state.
Yeah.
The state does contract with many vendors to provide services. And of the research that I've done at the federal level, when they've implemented these sorts of training programs, that's resulted in improvements in their hiring and practices.
And I want to add, Mr. Chair, I do appreciate the educational approach rather than starting with the punitive direction that seems like some of the legislation has gone or some of the proposals have forwarded. So I do appreciate that approach, and I think that's
punitive is always in the eyes of the punished. Vice Chair.
Well, or the direction of where the punishment is aimed, yes.
Other questions of Ms. Zeig? Okay, let's move on. Ms. Garner, I think you're going to give us some background to the issue, more sort of bigger picture. Is that right?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you so much for the opportunity to do a little bit of that.
Thank you.
I want to make two essential points.
Oh, yeah, and your name for the
record. Sorry, Trish Garner, sorry. You had... Mr. Chair had indicated it, so I figured you all knew it. But
you have
anyway.
To say it in your own natural voice.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we all are aware that the brunt of pay inequity falls on minorities, low-wage workers. But perhaps many of you may not know that the wage disparity hits different counties and different districts, different places within the state. I've provided to you something that was published by the State of Oregon Employment Department, and at the bottom right of that particular exhibit, it indicates that pay inequity is much worse in non-Portland metropolitan areas throughout the state. Women in the Northwest, and that this particular chart is looking at Clatsop, Columbia, and Tillamook counties. And it indicates that Northwest Oregon's women's earnings, again, in those counties, are about half of men's earnings statewide. They are 75%, that is, in these Northwest counties, 75% of statewide Oregonian women's salaries, so they're even less. And they are 64% of Northwest Oregon's men's earnings. So the point being that the inequity is even more inequitable than many of us may think. And as this bill seeks to inform people of the inequity and what pay equity is, it would seem to be particularly useful to highlight those factors. The second point that I wanted to make is addressed in an exhibit which I presented to you called Graduating to a Pay Gap. It was presented prepared by the American Association of University Women, the national group. And it was an attempt to look at, well, why is this gap happening as it is? Is it because women choose college majors, which are, you know, perhaps more social services rather than technology or business oriented? Are they choosing professions that follow that? So what this study did, and they were looking at graduates 1 year graduating out of college, that even when one controlled for the choice of major, the choice of economic sector, and also the number of hours worked, that college-educated women were earning at least 7% less than their male peers. Unfortunately, they or their parents probably also paid full-time tuition and expenses. So another primary conclusion of this graduating to a pay gap towards the end of the section of the report, it indicates that information is critical. Many people just assume gosh, this is just normal every day. This is how things should be and, you know, will always be. A lot of people, however, I don't think are really aware of the extent of the wage gap. And this legislation would promise to inform everyone, men and women, of the pros and cons of that kind of decision making. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Trish. Colleagues, any questions of Ms. Garner? Okay, thank you very much for giving us these studies and giving us that background. Thank you very much, Ms. Hyde. Is there anybody else here who wants to speak to Senate Bill 491? Come up and be counted. Sure, both of you can.
Okay.
And you'll have exactly equal time, so I'll keep an eye on the clock.
Okay, then.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association. We are a union of about 20,000 public and private sector union members, including employees who work for contractors. And we are here to testify in support of House Bill 491. We think that it adds good employee protection into the law for employees of contractors, and we support it.
Thank you. Mr. Tribbett.
Ryan Tribbett, here today testifying on behalf of the National Electrical Contractors Association and the Associated Wall and Ceiling Contractors, two signatory contractor associations representing over 300 businesses in the state, and we support this bill. We think that there could be some changes to improve it. I was disappointed to hear that there was an amendment to raise the threshold. When I spoke with my clients about it, they would like to lower the threshold to somewhere in the ballpark of 10 employees. From their background, they have informed me that shops of 10 can be putting in bids for projects of $500,000 figure. And so to sort of marry up those two thresholds, we thought, at least on the construction side, that 10 was probably a more appropriate one. I believe I understood the testimony of the previous people saying that they're going to move the sort of statute that this is going into some more of the responsible contractor statute. Initially, when we read it, it seemed a little clunky being in the prequal area because prequal is not necessarily a requirement of bidding for all public agencies. Not all of them have a prequal process. So if the goal is to capture companies bidding on public work, the best way to do that would be through the responsible contractor statutes. And then that said, I mean, I guess part of why we were excited to see is we've been in the pay equity business for over 100 years. The pay requirements based on worker classification, regardless of gender, is sort of what we've done for a very, very long time. That's all I got to say.
Thank you very much. Trish, you want to
add
to that?
And, Mr. Chair, if I might add, we would support the amendments that Mr. Tribbett just outlined.
Okay. Madeline, could you come back up?
Mr. Chair, if you don't mind, I've brought the procurement person up from DAS who can probably answer these sorts of questions a little bit more effectively than I can.
That would be great.
Okay, I'll switch with you.
And these are things, of course, we can work out outside of this meeting, but it would be useful since they've been raised and everybody's in the room. Thank you.
Thank you. For the record, Diane Lancaster, the Chief Procurement Officer for the Department of Administrative Services, and thank you for having me come up. This is record-breaking kinds of issues for us. Procurement has been involved in some sorts of environmental and community support kinds of activities. To be allowed to now come in and to use contracting activities to support pay equity issues, we think is a privilege. The amendments are not finalized, to my knowledge. I want to agree with what Mr. Tribbett commented on in the pre-qualification piece. We thought that was a bit clunky, so we'll be collaborating on smoothing out some of the pieces that might be difficulties in implementing the process. As far as lowering the threshold, I'll leave that for some further discussion, and we'll see what develops across the conversational lines. But I think generally the procurement community at the state government level is knowledgeable about the bill. We've been discussing it. We are already doing a number of checklist points when we go through a bidder responsibility consideration. This would be one more, and you know, we would treat it as such. I'll answer any questions if you have them.
Well, just to the point of the 10 employees as opposed mm-hmm. to 50, are we talking about a lot of companies that bid, and is your sense that this would present an undue hardship on them? You know, obviously a company that has 50 or more is in a better position to address these things, but on the other hand, we're not talking about a really substantial kind of requirement. How does that balance out from your perspective?
Chair Denborough, members of the committee, clearly when you lower the threshold, it will be more inclusive. There would be more contractors, more bidders who would be expected to obtain this training and certification. $500,000 is a substantive amount. It's not the biggest. But I think the willingness of the smaller firms to participate, as these good folk have testified to me, is encouraging. We started thinking about this number, and I was asked about 40 or 50, and that was sort of, well, at that level, we have a company of a size enough that they would have need of knowing about these laws. And we were somewhat hesitant to recommend a smaller number because we thought, well, maybe the burden of training and getting a certification might be a difficulty. But I am encouraged by the testimony. And as far as the procurement process is concerned, we have to check bidder responsibility no matter what the size of the company that is coming to the table. And so there's a certain, I think, frankly, there's a certain equitability about saying we're going to expect pretty much everybody that comes to the table to be knowledgeable and know about these laws and to have a chance to certify they're in compliance. So we would certainly be willing to try to support that level of process. And I can't speak for the businesses, of course, but that would be our hope.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Lancaster.
You're welcome.
Yes, Tricia.
Mr. Chair, to this point, for our members, we typically deal with multinational corporations, very large, who have multiple contracts with various school districts. And if the employee threshold is high, the same company will have different standards in different locations. Because if I understand this correctly, it's based on the contract. So for a student, for example, might have in Gresham Barlow, they would be required to meet the contract, the requirements of this bill, but not necessarily in Oak Ridge. So we think having a standard that applies to all workers, the protections in this bill would apply to all workers, is a better standard than some workers.
Thank you. Colleagues, questions? Okay, then. We'll try to get together and see about amendments. Matt, you can maybe shepherd that.
Sure.
All right. Thank you very much. Anybody else on this issue? All right. Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 491. And, colleagues, if you don't mind, since we're all here together at this moment, let's do the work session on 586. So I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 586. And Vice Chair Thatcher.
Yeah. Okay, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 586 to the floor with a due pass recommendation that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Vice Chair Thatcher moves Senate Bill 586 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Colleagues, that last part is an addition, the referral to Ways and Means. Matt, could you remind us what this bill is and why we are making that change?
Yes, Senate Bill 586 increases the age of youth for whom the Youth Development Council may oversee services from age 20 to age 24. And this bill does have a fiscal impact, and that has led to the recommendation for subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Thank you. And colleagues, this, you know, as you recall, we, you know, our goal here was to allow the Youth Development Council to deal with employment issues for young people who had sort of aged out of their normal age cohort, and that suggested that we increase their age cohort. But there are other things that the YDC does aside from youth employment, and the it leads to a fiscal, and so the and that's why this subsequent referral is on it. So any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I still have concerns that it could potentially take away money. It could shift money from the younger groups that are being focused on right now to, I guess, maybe spreading it a little too thin. And I don't know. I just am becoming less effective that way because mm-hmm. we can't do everything for everybody.
I think that's why it's going to require additional dollars, and hence the fiscal that we had not anticipated. But that's something that Ways and Means will have to decide. You know, do we have the resources to, you know, to extend this program in that way? Any further discussion? Okay, is there any objection to our approving this motion? Okay, seeing no objection, the motion passes. The bill sent to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. All right, I'll close this work session on Senate Bill 586, and I'm going to open a work session, I'm sorry, a public hearing on Senate Bill 291. And Matt, can you please summarize this bill?
Senate Bill 291, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, is it modifies the circumstances under which injured state workers have a right to reinstatement or reemployment, declaring emergency effective on passage.
Okay. Let's have Deb Bogart and John Schultz come up. And anyone else from the agency who needs to? So who's going to lead us through this? Ms. Bogart, Mr. Schultz?
I can.
Okay.
Oh, Penny will. Thank you.
All right, great.
Good afternoon, Chair Dembro, members of the committee. My name's Penny Evans. I'm the risk manager with the Department of Administrative Services Risk Management Program. And we're here today to talk to you about Senate Bill 291. We have a short PowerPoint we're going to walk through in a moment, and then also take time for any questions you might have. Go ahead and
Chair Dembro and committee members, I'm Deborah Bogart with the Department of Administrative Services Risk Management Program, and I'm here today to give you some information regarding Senate Bill 291. Senate Bill 291 pertains to ORA 659A052, and basically this statute provides that state injured workers have additional benefits than those provided to most other injured state workers. Specifically, the statute provides that in addition to reinstatement and reemployment opportunities after they have been injured, within the agency that they were injured in, they have additional rights to placement in other agencies. DAS basically under House Bill 278 in 2009 was directed to adopt its policies for placement of state injured workers in other agencies and turn those policies into Oregon administrative rules. 2778 was enrolled in 2009, and shortly after, DAS did adopt those rules. The administrative rules address two separate issues. One is light duty assignments for injured workers. These are assignments that are temporary in nature. In other words, at that time, we aren't expecting permanent partial disability or the injured worker to not be able to return to their job at injury. The other administrative rule addresses the injured worker's preference to placement in entry-level positions. So that one addresses the more permanent placement of injured workers post-injury. For the temporary placement, the rules provide that first the agency must look at modifying the job in which they were injured. If they're not able to do that, then secondly, the agency must look for other positions within that agency to return an injured worker to modified duty. If that is not possible, what these rules basically say is that outside the agency is optional in temporary placement. For permanent placement, it's very similar, except that if it's not possible to place an injured worker within the agency in which they were injured, they must place an injured worker in another state agency, according to the permanent restrictions that have been assigned that worker. The intent of this concept is basically to avoid future claims. Things went along fairly well with these statutes up until 2 years ago when we received a lawsuit from an injured worker who claimed that we did not do enough to provide work for them on a temporary basis in another state agency. DOJ advised us at that time that there was a disconnect between the administrative rules that we adopted and the statute, and recommended that we come forward and try to make it a little more clear in statute that an injured worker does not always have the right to placement in another state agency. With these rules, or with the amendments that we have to statute, we do continue to provide the same additional level that we have been providing in the past. It's more of an effort to align the statute with the rules that are in place. In addition, over the past few weeks, we've been in conversations with the Management Labor Advisory Committee regarding Senate Bill 291 and with representatives from a union. And in those conversations, we have also proposed some amendments to 291, which we only have drafts of those amendments.
They're always keeping us working.
and we're sorry. And I'm not sure if you received copies of
so.
That.
I don't think so, Matt. Did we? No.
I did bring some copies of the proposed amendments if you wanted to take a look at those.
That would be great. Since you're here, we could at least get a sense of what the issues are. Thank you. And while we're getting those, I do have a question. So the placement, whether temporary or permanent, does that have to be to a vacant position, or can an employee bump another employee in order to fulfill this requirement?
It has to be suitable and available, and the available portion of that would address the vacancy portion of it. There's actually within those rules specific language that disallows the movement or bumping. You can transfer work, but you can't move an employee in a certain position.
Okay, so we have these amendments. Can you give us an idea of what needs to be changed and why? And this came after conversations with the MLAC people or in anticipation of that?
After conversations with both MLAC and with AFSCME.
Okay, thank you.
So with the rules or the statutes, the way they're currently written, they seem to imply that an injured worker has the right to go to another agency regardless of the nature of the injury or whether it's a temporary or a permanent placement. The statute in itself is fairly simple, but because it is a Bureau of Labor and Industries statute, Bureau of Labor and Industries has rules that address reinstatement, reemployment. Within the statute that we're amending, it also requires the Department of Administrative Services to have rules that address this. So a person coming in and looking at these from the outside, an injured worker, their attorney representative, they rely on this language primarily. If they're going to go look at the BOLI administrative rules, which would be the intuitive thing to do, they're not going to be aware of DAS's administrative rules. So they're being misinterpreted. So basically what we're trying to do with this clarification is to state that it's mandatory to place an injured worker in another state agency when we're looking at permanent placement up until the time that we know their permanent restrictions and what all those would entail. It's a temporary placement. We would look at those on a case-by-case basis to see whether or not it was prudent at that time to place another injured worker in a different state agency. So the language here is just if we know all the permanent restrictions of an injured worker, and we've gone through and evaluated what those are. We look for the suitable and available according to the policies that we have. Then we would place the injured worker. The majority of this text, you see the state of Oregon as an employer in many different ways, as a collection of departments, as an employer in looking at the state as a whole, or in this situation, and it's the only statute I know that does that, is looks at an injured worker in terms of the branch of government that they work in. So the previous language for 052 separated out that an executive branch employee only has rights to placement in an executive branch agency, and the same for judicial branch and the legislative branch. The only language that is being added in that is to make it clear that for the available and suitable position, it used to say any agency, which was interpreted after we submitted this amendment to be that it included that we would not even place an injured worker within the agency at injury. So we set another agency to make it clear that this is only addressing that situation, that state workers always have the right to reinstatement and reemployment within the agency that they work in. So any questions on that?
That makes sense. And, you know, the other thing that it does is excise this language about medically stationary.
We had originally, in lieu of saying permanent restrictions, used the word medically stationary. We chose medically stationary because it is a point in time in the claim of an injured worker that you can point to that says at this point they're not going to get any better, they're not going to get any worse. We can evaluate what their permanent restrictions are. In our conversations after the Management Labor Advisory Committee meetings, the union was a little uncomfortable with the medically stationary, saying that that could extend out over many, many years and an injured worker could languish. And so we compromised with all permanent restrictions in lieu of medically stationary. It's a little more nebulous when you know all permanent restrictions as opposed to medically stationary, but it's something we can work with.
Great, thank you. Mr. Schultz, do you have anything to add?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm John Schultz, Administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division, which is part of the Department of Consumer Business Services. And I would be happy to answer any questions. And the one thing that I'd have to add is the Management Labor Advisory Committee is ready to provide a recommendation to the legislature when the amendments are finalized and this comes back in front of the committee. We'll be meeting this Friday as well as 2 weeks from this Friday. So when those amendments are ready, they'll be able to give you a recommendation.
Mm-hmm. And they'll be looking at these draft amendments then this week?
We'd be looking at these, if these are the amendments that come out of Legislative Council, and I have no reason to believe that those would change. So, yes.
Great, thank you. Colleagues, any questions? Okay, this seems pretty straightforward. Just let us know when you have amendments. Thank you.
Thank you
very much.
Okay, great. Okay, with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 291. Yeah, colleagues, let's stand at ease for a few minutes. We're waiting. Okay, colleagues, we're back in session. We are ready now to open our public hearing on Senate Bill 311. Matt, can you tell us what this bill does? And Senator Shields will tell us why we should do it.
Senate Bill 311 considers foster parents as public employees for the purpose of labor organization, prohibits foster parents from striking, and designates appropriate bargaining units for foster parents.
Senator Shields, welcome.
A very good submission. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chip Shields. I represent North and Northeast Portland in the Oregon State Senate, and my wife and I have also been foster parents. And the main reason this bill is before you is because I want to just continue this conversation. This bill has been around for about two or three sessions. It's not ready for prime time, so keep your ammo if you want to for the time that you really might need to fight this bill.
We do have to we do have to exercise our weapons occasionally.
That's right.
So thank you for giving us that opportunity.
Yeah. But I think we really need to make some improvements in how we deliver foster care in this state. And this is one way to potentially do that. I think we really need to elevate the quality of fostering in this state, and that could mean professionalizing foster care in this state to really make foster parents want to be foster parents, the ones that get into the system want to be here, excel at it, feel supported, get the 24-hour support they need to really turn each foster home into true homes of healing. And this, you know, if I've had a number of conversations with, you know, Republicans who are foster parents, and you know, they say, okay, well, we need to be able to come together and elect representation democratically. It would be great if we could take a little bit out of our pay and put it together so that we can have some representation in some of these matters in the Capitol, and also if we could somehow get a way to negotiate with DHS for more support and better training. And so that doesn't necessarily have to be a union. Maybe it could just be a real beefed up association. But I think we need to figure out a way to get foster parents here at this table. And if you think about it, every single group associated with child welfare has representation in this building. Judges have representation. Lawyers who do juvenile dependency have representation. Caseworkers have representation. The agency has representation. And we often pass policy without having foster parents down here. And the reason, frankly, is a pretty simple one. Most foster parents that I've come into contact are at wit's end with just how they're going to be able to manage the really, really challenging circumstances of their traumatized foster kids that are in front of them. So this is it's an idea whose time, frankly, has not come, but one that I think we need to continue to work on. I also want to let you know that I've joined the board of the Oregon Foster Parent Association, which is just has, you know, probably about 20 to 25 members, but there's chapters all around the state. And over the next 2 years, we'll be really diving into kind of a board development process with retreats and maybe some stakeholder groups around the state. And DHS has been very helpful in that. They give the Oregon Foster Parent Association a contract to be supportive of foster parents. And we hope to really beef up our muscle and come back with some recommendations on how to really elevate the quality of fostering to make each foster home a true home of healing. It's, we got to do better for these kids.
Senator Knope.
Thank you,
Senator Shields.
Thank you, Senator Shields. You did leave out family physicians. They also have representation in this building, and they deal with foster kids as well. But my question for you is, since you've been a foster parent, tell me about the reimbursement rates as they compare maybe to other states, and also how other states handle a foster parent organization, so they're a stronger knit group that can advocate.
It's a good question. What I do know is that historically our reimbursements have been at the bottom, close to the bottom, in the bottom two or three. Occasionally, when DHS has come in and advocated, we've thrown some more money to maybe bring us, you know, maybe to the top, towards the middle of the pack. But then when times get tough again, that money goes away. Most of the time when I'm talking to foster parents, it's not the money that they're most worried about. It's the degree of support. It's figuring out who to call at 2 a.m. when a 10-year-old little girl is literally pounding her head against the wall, and the foster parent has no idea what to do in that situation. The other thing that I wanted to bring to your attention is I took the foster parents in my district with the help of DHS out to dinner at Widmere Brewing. They had, you know, a little conference room. And so I brought them together, bought them dinner just to say thanks. But then I also wanted to ask them how they would improve foster care if they could wave a magic wand. And I'll never forget the story of this one woman who said, you know, my vocation and what I think I'm called to do is to clean up other people's messes. And I'm very, very good with the kids. I'm not independently wealthy. And every time I advocate for myself and the kid and the family for more resources, people think that I'm only in it for the money. And I said, huh, I hadn't quite thought of it that way, that, you know, just the mere fact of advocating, people dismiss you that you're only in it for the money. And it struck me, because maybe you've heard this conversation, that, well, they're good foster parents and they're bad foster parents, and, you know, some are in for the money and some aren't. And, you know, I never really thought of it in quite that precise way. As far as what other states are doing, I do know that Washington went a step towards allowing foster parents to organize. DHS might know more about that, but they passed kind of an organizing light bill as far as their kind of associations in other states. I'm not very familiar.
Okay, I have a couple of questions, Jim. So I definitely hear you about a sense both, you know, among a lot of foster parents and just people out in the public that foster parents are not getting the kind of compensation or support that they need. And, you know, especially, you know, where I think they're expected to have other sources of income. They're not supposed to be relying on this. And yet, in some cases, especially when they have two or three, it's going to be hard for them, depending on the circumstances, to hold full-time jobs while they're acting as foster parents. And I'm wondering, to what extent do you see foster parents as maybe not public employees, maybe not state employees, but doing the state's business? And, I mean, that seems to be what's kind of behind this notion of forming a state-sanctioned organization.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. It is. You should also know that current case law has made this kind of thing more difficult, and it would require some challenges to kind of thread the needle on even making this viable at this point. But I think that, I think generally we've got to figure out a way to provide better support for foster parents. I think whenever anybody in this building has an idea on improving foster care, it's usually to give money to somebody other than improving the training and quality of fostering. It's lawyers need this, or, you know, and all those things are important. But I think that's part of the challenge, is that they have no representation here. Maybe there are other steps that we can make to beef up the organization. Did I answer your question?
Yeah. And we'll talk to DHS as well about that.
Yeah, I guess one thing, you know, one of the challenges with the case law now is that those, from my understanding, and you probably know a lot more about this, but you need to be considered an employee in order to organize, or at least that's kind of how a lot of people are reading the decision. I'm wondering if there might be a way that that foster parents could come together and negotiate collectively without having to get overtime pay when they work more than 8 hours in a day. And that's something that we haven't quite explored yet.
Questions of the senator? Yes, Vice Chair Thatcher.
Perish the thought, but maybe we need another work group. Seriously.
Hey, I hear a volunteer.
Yeah. Sounds like a problem. It does need to be hashed out, though.
Yeah, well, I will take you as a volunteer, Senator Thatcher. I think you'd be good. One thing I will say, Mr. Chair, I'm very hopeful about all of the energy around foster care right now. I think the efforts at the state level, their willingness to try new things, their willingness to support the Oregon Foster Parent Association, the fact that they're probably a third of all legislators have had foster kids in their home at some point or another, it seems to me. And I think part of the challenge has been over the years that it just seemed like such a big, huge issue that we all knew was going to cost a lot of money, that we were afraid to try anything. And so I'm energized that there's so many people willing to roll up their sleeves and say, okay, just because we can't do everything, doesn't mean we can't do anything, right? And so I think we just need to nibble away at this and every session be able to raise the bar on the quality of fostering, make each home a true home of healing.
Thank you. Can I ask you one last question
Yes.
before you leave? And that is, what is it that led you to become a foster parent? Was it the result of a lot of conversations, you know, with your wife? I mean, what got you to that point?
It was a pretty personal decision, so I don't want to go into the details of that. But, you know, I'm a social worker by training. She's a nurse practitioner. And we just saw that there were so many kids in our state that we were failing, and we wanted to do something about it.
Great, thank you. All right, thanks, Senator.
Thanks.
You're certainly willing to stay. If you're willing, you're certainly welcome to stay, or you can watch from above.
I do need to get back to committee, though, but thank you.
Thanks. Okay, I'll call up. We have Lois Day. And Chris, are you coming up as well? No.
Thank you, Chair Dimbrough. For the record, my name's Lois Day. I'm the Child Welfare Director at the Department of Human Services. The department is neutral on this bill, but I did want to offer a few observations about our foster care system and hearing your questions. For Senator Shields, I may not be able to respond to all your questions, but I am committed to bringing you whatever information you would like around the foster care system we have in Oregon. I also want to really commend Senator Shields for bringing this issue forward again, because the foster care system is a critical piece of any child welfare program, including ours, and his interest and willingness to champion for foster parents is greatly appreciated by the department. So as I said, foster care, family foster care, is an essential service that any child welfare system depends on. It's a safety service intended to be temporary in nature. It's reliant on community members stepping forward to be willing to bring, to bring these children into their home, to care for them, to nurture them, to keep them safe while their parents are dealing with the issues that create the lack of safety in their home. In Oregon, we rely first on relatives, family members, to be our foster placements, and we search for family members in the beginning to find one that may be fit and willing to care for the child while the parents do their work. Approximately 30% of our foster placements are with relatives. We also recruit what we call general applicant foster parents who don't know the children who are coming into the program but who are willing to take children as they come in. The more foster homes we have ready and available for children creates greater stability in our system. Our goal is to have a good match of a child's needs and the skill sets of a foster parent when a child comes into care. And that creates less moves for foster children when they're in our system. Each move is a traumatic experience for a child, especially when having been removed from their parents. So we want to minimize those moves in our system. In 2013, 45% of the families that we certified were certified for child-specific placements. They knew the child that was coming into the system or came into the system and wanted to be that placement. The rate methodology we have in Oregon for establishing foster care rates is based on two national studies and one Oregon study that deal with the costs of raising a child. That's how we determine our rates. And it is a reimbursement. It's not a payment. It's not a salary. It's a reimbursement of costs, and it's a partial reimbursement of costs, not the full reimbursement of the cost of raising a child. In our rule, we have the areas we believe that we have set out that that rate addresses. Those areas are food, clothing, housing, daily supervision, personal incidentals, and transportation. And that encompasses the totality of the payment that we make for foster parents. And then it's based further on age. We have three groupings of age, 0 to 5, 6 to 12, and 13 to 20. The rate increases in those three areas as the child ages. Children, as you can imagine, children that come into our care, some of them have been greatly traumatized and have behaviors that are particularly challenging. And we do have what's called we do an assessment of children when they come into care called the Child Adolescent Strengths and Needs Screening. We call it CANS for short, so I always have to look and see what that CANS stands for. And what that creates is three additional levels of a compensation for a foster parent based on the increased supervision needs that these children have. About 35% of the children in our system qualify for one of those three levels, so that is an enhanced payment a foster parent can get. And then finally, we have what we call personal care rates. They're children that come into our system that have high medical needs. And we have a nurse that we keep under contract who assesses a foster parent's ability to meet those specific medical needs of a child, and there can be an enhanced payment for that extra skill set that that foster parent brings to that placement. You know, every day there are children coming into our system that are stressed, distressed, and traumatized. And I actually believe we have a healthy and diverse foster care system that helps those children, and greatly appreciate the community members that step forward to take care of them. So I'm available to answer, hopefully, any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Thanks, Ms. Day. You talked about three levels of compensation, or actually multiple levels, depending on the age of the child or the needs of the child.
Yes.
So what sort of monthly reimbursement are we talking about?
So we have what's called the base rate. That's the one divided by age. That's a partial reimbursement for costs. For a child 0 to 5 years of age, it's $575 a month, which is approximately $19 a day. For a child 6 to 12 years of age, it's $655 a month, which is $21.53 a day. And for a child 13 to 20 years of age, it's $741 a month, which breaks down to $24.36 a day. If the child is found to fit one of the three levels of the CANS assessment, if they're level one, it's an additional $6.96 a day, which is $212 monthly, regardless of the age. Level two is $414 a month, or $13.61 a day. And level three is $850 a month, or $27.90 a day, and that's on top of the basic rate.
Thank you. And again, these rates, at least at the base level, maybe it's different at the CANS level, I don't know. There's an expectation that this is not income for the family. The parents, or at least one parent, has to be gainfully employed, right?
Chair Denbrough, members of the committee, it is not a wage, and the family is expected to have another source of income.
And how much of a source of income? I mean, you know, are there instances in which people are becoming foster parents to help make ends meet? I guess that's the question.
Chair Denbrough, members of the committee, it's not a set amount that has to be made. It's an income that allows the family to meet their bills without the foster care payment. So when an additional child comes into the home, I think that's why it's partial reimbursement. If they're already meeting their house payment, et cetera, this is to add to that. We have some families, we can certify a family of two for up to eight children. And so in those families, it's a sizable amount of money, but again, they're supporting eight additional children in their home. It is not intended to be a source of employment for family foster care.
If you were to have eight children in a home, of course, depending on the age of the children, you would expect that one of those parents is going to be home a lot, right?
Chair Denbrough, members of the committee, we don't provide daycare payments. So there needs to be an adult in the home who can manage the children that are placed in the home.
And whose job is it to determine that a family is correct, that the home situation and the means of the family are appropriate for a placement? you know, by depending on the number of children, of course.
Chair Denborough, members of the committee, we have a, it's the department's job to make that determination. We have what's called the Safe Home Study, which is a home study that looks at sort of all aspects of the family, and if there are any areas of concern, gives us additional opportunity to speak with the family, parents separately and together, to determine whether or not they would be a good match for the foster care system. That certifier is the worker that does that. That certifier stays with the family, and we have recertification. There's a background check, a criminal background check, and a child abuse check for the family before they're approved for foster placement. And then families are approved for up to a certain number of children, but not all families are approved for up to the limit of the number that can be in the home. Then when a child is, there's a process where when a child comes into care, we look to make sure that, or we look to assure a good match between the family and the child. And the child, each child that's in that home has a caseworker who is then required to see the child on a monthly basis and assess how that child is doing in care, and part of that is how they're doing in that particular foster home.
Vice President.
Thank you. I guess I had a question that kind of goes back to what Senator Shields is talking about. The supports. What supports do foster parents have? Who to call at 2 a.m. when there's a, you know, a child who has high needs and is acting out? What, you know, what kind of supports are available?
Chair Denborough, Senator Thatcher, there's a variety of supports available for foster parents, and I think individual foster parents, depending upon the situations they encounter, may find those adequate or not adequate. We have a training program, both in-person training and as well as a remote training, so that regardless of where you are in the state, you can access the full library of trainings that we have available. Foster homes, our expectation is that they have a number they can call. They should know who their caseworkers are as well as their certifier. If there's a child at 2 in the morning who's acting out and creating a risk to the home or to themselves, our expectation is they would either call that individual from the department that they have access to, or they would call law enforcement to assist them. We have a hotline in Portland that has an after-hours call line to it. So there's a variety of ways foster parents could get that support. I would say that if at 2 in the morning you have a child that's doing the behavior you describe, it would present a challenge to feel supported enough. That's not a situation that we want foster parents and our children either to find themselves in. Chair Denborough, members of the committee, I would just offer one additional comment based on Senator Shields' testimony around the kind of systems that are around the country. I'm not prepared to speak to how our compensation measures up to other compensation around the country, but there is a wide variety of ways the foster care program is managed in states. Each state is individual. Some states have privatized, and it's not a department function to provide the foster care when children come into care. Some states rely heavily on what they call congregate care, which is less a family home care, more of not an institutional setting, but a setting where there's multiple children there that's not a family-like setting. In Oregon, we have made the decision not to have that kind of care, and we have very little of congregate care in Oregon. We rely on family foster care, believing families to be a better place for children to be raised. We also have an initiative, actually it's a multi-year strategy to reduce the number of children who have a foster care experience, because in and of itself, removal is traumatic, and our efforts at the department are towards supporting families to be able to safely parent while they're addressing their issues. So I just wanted to let you know that no two states necessarily look alike, and states have varying levels of foster care organizing and working with the department. We consider ourselves partners with foster parents, and that can sometimes be difficult given our responsibility around monitoring the home as well as the children in the home. But certainly look forward to working further, especially with Senator Shields and others who are invested in this program, to strengthen it.
Thank you. You know, it's interesting because, you know, people who care for children on the state's behalf, you know, through various daycare kinds of settings, that they're clearly workers. Foster parents are, in a sense, state workers as well, right? They're doing the work of the state in caring for these wards of the state, essentially. And although, you know, at first blush, the notion of foster parents as state workers seems preposterous, you know, I think, you know, as you think it through, you know, there is a kind of a logic there, I think. And that's why we're talking about it here in the workforce committee. That, you know, many of these issues could have been taken up in the Human Services Committee as well. But we're thinking of the work that these foster parents do kind of as workers on behalf of the state. I'm wondering, going to the issue of compensation, where could we go to find out how our compensation levels compare to other states that also use family care? Is that information you could get for us?
Senator Dimbro, I will attempt. I believe I can get that information for you, yes, okay, and I will do that.
Great. I appreciate that. On the issue of, you know, sort of not institutional care, but, you know, something like that, I think Multnomah County used to have a program where kids could be put in a short-term kind of emergency setting. You know, if something happens and they need to be removed from the home at the middle of the night, for example, where they could be placed for a limited amount of time. And I've heard positive things about that. That went away for funding reasons, I think. But as things stand now, they would have to be placed in a foster home, right?
Chair Dimbro, yes, they would be placed in a foster home, and we do have foster homes who come into our system specifically to take children who are in that moment of crisis and take them at any hour of the day and night, and then we have a process of assessing that child's needs in a family-type setting.
So how, you know, in that kind of situation, how long might that real short-term placement be?
Chair Dimbro, it's called shelter care. It's a two-week process. Sometimes the children will stay in that home. Sometimes they will move to a different home. That also gives us time to investigate the possibility of placement with family, where they may move to a relative placement after that.
And could you just speak to the sort of relative merits of the two models for that sort of situation?
Chair Dimbro, I think there's a lot of different opinions about the merits of those, both those settings. What I would say is what's common between them is the opportunity for an assessment of the child. The assessment center model requires a move after placement. The shelter care model, where they move into a family home, may not require a move, so that would be a difference between the two. Both have strengths and both have some shortcomings.
Other things for Ms. Day? All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ms. Day. Anyone else want to speak? I don't know why you all are here. You're very, very welcome.
Thank you. We're from Pacific University. We're all students and faculty at the MSW, bachelor's in social work and master's in social work programs. So we thought that this was a very relevant issue to our work.
Yeah, thank you. Anybody have anything they want to say about foster youth system, you know, foster care system in Oregon? This is your chance.
I don't think it'd be helpful.
Actually, why don't you come forward and get on the record? You'll get extra credit for it. Come on up.
Well, I was appreciative of the question that you asked about compensation.
Thank you.
Okay, just tell us who you are and anything you want to say about your thoughts on the foster care system.
Sure. So my name is Jessica Ritter. I'm a social work professor at Pacific University in Forest Grove, Oregon. And Dr. Don Schweitzer, a professor of social work at Pacific University in Forest Grove, Oregon, and at the Eugene MSW program.
So actually, Dr. Schweitzer and I both share a pretty, I guess, passionate, you know, care for foster youth. Before I became a professor of social work, I actually worked as a caseworker in child protection. So I think, you know, over the years, we've just learned that this is a population that usually doesn't get the support. There's a lot of research showing that when you age out of the foster care system, the immense problems they face down the road in terms of increased pregnancy rates, living in poverty, homelessness. I mean, the picture is just pretty dire for these youth. So, you know, we would certainly be in support of any funding and any programs that would support this pretty vulnerable population of youth.
And I would just add to the actual prevention of putting a young person into foster care to begin with. I mean, there are some models out there that Oregon, I think, family reunification models. I've done some research in those kind of areas where a few dollars of support to a family can prevent this whole catastrophic event from even happening. That seems like money well spent kind of in that area versus years of foster care and then oftentimes the negative outcomes that happen once they age out of foster care.
So. Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. We have here in the legislature over the last few sessions, we've had young people from the Oregon Foster Youth Connection mm-hmm. come and speak to us, you know, just directly from their experience of the challenges that they face. And, you know, I know many of us have really learned a lot from that. Mm-hmm. And they've really done a good job, as I say, of self-advocating, whereas what we're hearing in this what we heard from Senator Shields earlier was we don't have the same sort of thing for foster youth parents, mm-hmm. and that is a population that probably they need to figure out and we need to figure out how can we allow them to better self-advocate mm-hmm. To make sure that their needs are met, because the kids' needs won't be met if the foster parents' needs aren't met.
Well, and I think that also would play into the relationship that they would build with the foster youth. The less connected, the less, you know, the more disempowered a foster parent feels about, you know, their relationship, you know, is that going to impact the dynamic that they have with that foster child? You know, I would suggest, yes, that would. And anything that would empower a foster parent, on the other hand, would hopefully strengthen that relationship, which I think research clearly shows is one of the issues with the foster care system.
Yeah, and Chair Denbrough and members of the committee, I think I definitely learned working with foster parents that they often feel very disempowered. So anything I think that would give them just more of a voice would probably be a pretty positive thing, yeah.
Okay, great. Okay, thank you both very much for coming forward. And you guys get to grade them. Okay, colleagues, with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 311. I just want to note for the record that Senate Bill 491, the one that we talked about first about pay equity, Representative Comp was hoping to come, but the mm-hmm. House is amazingly still in session. And so she has submitted written testimony, and so for the record, that's been entered. And I think we have hard copy if you'd like it. So with that, if there's nothing else for the good of the order, we are adjourned. Week 5 is over for us. Week 5 is over for us. We are adjourned.